If you wonder what I've been doing, I have been giving an analysis of where we are in order to give an exposition of how we got to where we are. And I took up the problem of our political life, our political decline. I took up the problem of our economic and fiscal decline. I took up something of the problem of the decline in culture. And I want to go back to that today in a type of recapitulation to explain really what has happened to our culture. And actually, modern culture, both in Europe and in this country, and by that I mean modern art, modern music, modern drama, modern literature, architecture, and so on, are in a conscious revolt against Christianity. It is not accidental. It is a conscious revolt. For instance, allow me to cite modern music. Modern music began its turn to the irrational, certainly by the time of Richard Wagner, who consciously wrote music on the irrational level. Now, many people have failed to see this because he was a skilled musician, and I would not for a moment in any way indicate that he was not a master musician and as a composer. And this is what makes him so dangerous. Many people listen to the Marx and Tannhauser and think it is fine. And it has the mark of genius. I wouldn't deny that. Or Thou Sweet Evening Star, or his magic cycle, Rienzi, Tristan and Isolde, and so on. They are a conscious exaltation of pagan themes. This is not accidental. He does it very well. But he did it consciously. If you will read Jacques Barzon's great book, Darwin, Marx, and Wagner, you will see exactly what Wagner was trying to do. He was adapting Darwin to the Germanic concept of Teutonic superiority. And he did it by the very, very skillful use of the irrational in music. But he did conceal it. Although cultivated Germans knew exactly what he was up to. You must remember that Wagner wrote at the same time that Bismarck was conducting his Kulturkampf. And the same time that Bismarck was therefore conducting two campaigns. One against the German Catholic Church, because he regarded the German Catholic Church as a great obstacle to his Kulturkampf. And in essence, he was correct in his understanding of their opposition. But Wagner was very subtly aiding this development. And Wagner, in his letters to Charles Darwin, made it very clear that he was adapting Charles Darwin to the German scene. Even, of course, as was Karl Marx, but I'll come to that later. The point I'm making is this, that modern music is a plunge into the irrational. It is a deliberate, defiant, revolutionary denial of creation, in the sense that creation in its aesthetics bears the mark of a divinely implanted harmony. And modern music bears this stamp very, very clearly. I could cite many examples of that. George Hindemith, the noted piano player and composer, bears this mark. Most modern music is dedicated to the proposition that there is no truth, no fundamental truth of any kind. Modern art is dedicated to this proposition. One time at Salem College, we had an art show, and we had an artist who was showing his pictures, and they had the art department ask me if I'd help him hang this picture. And we had an awful time. And we thought we had it right side up, and we got upside down. He was very angry at us for hanging his picture upside down. And after it got over his wrath, I asked him what it was supposed to mean. And he said that it represented chickens falling down the staircase in the second floor home. And another man was the man. I shouldn't have said this, but I said, well, sir, I said, we don't keep chickens on our second floor. We happened at that time to be living in a two-story home and wasn't selling. And to begin with, the man was mad, in my opinion, for having chickens on the second floor. And secondly, for painting them as they fell down the staircase. And that was the theme of this supposed great piece of work in art. I heard Wright, the great architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, admit that his architecture was an expression of his atheism. Much of modern literature is the expression of an irrational determinism. Much, if not most, of our modern drama is of this nature. Certainly our modern novels represent this trend of thought, and so on. The hopeless determinism of the irrational. And this is a very, very clearly marked trend in our day. It's a rebellion against law. And, of course, our social life is also a conscious rebellion against law. The present emphasis of sex outside of marriage has virtually destroyed, as you know, the moral fiber and the moral consciousness, the moral sensitivity of many people, until an ethical relativism has earned a grip. This is conscious. This is purposeful. It's not accidental. It's a well-designed plan on the part of liberalism to destroy its enemies. And therefore, of course, they must destroy American culture. The whole present emphasis upon freedom is a gross caricature in freedom. There is no freedom in the present concept of freedom. The Women's Lib movement is really the same thing. When you examine the Women's Lib movement, what's really behind it? It's an attempt to overthrow the order of creation. That's exactly what's behind it. It's an attempt to set aside the divinely created distinctions between the sexes. If you really pin the people down who are the conscious leaders of the movement, you will see that this is true. It is designed to do away with the God-ordained differences between the two sexes and to promote a false, a dangerously false concept of democracy, which has no place in Christian thinking or in the Church of Jesus Christ. Now let's come to the problem of where we are in education. Perhaps here we see more clearly than any other place the devastating results of a conscious revolt against the whole theistic concept of man and of God and of government and even of education. Today, in my opinion, education is a house divided. It is a movement, it is an institution, which is, first of all, morally degenerate, intellectually degenerate, and from the point of view of creating good citizens, it is degenerate from the point of view of government. No longer is education concerned with purveying or consciously conveying truth. This is not the idea in the modern school movement. For this one reason, there's no truth to convey. There's no real purpose in teaching truth because there's nothing worthwhile to teach. Thus, the teacher has become what? He has become a comrade in arms, a student, and together they're both plowing through a great deal of data, hopefully find some little morsels of truth somewhere, but it won't be truth. It'll be simply something which is pragmatically possible for the moment. Textbooks are not written to convey truth. And frankly, in present psychology, there's nobody to teach. Because you're not teaching people, you're teaching B.F. Skinner's little pieces of determined hunks of something living, matter, who are so fairly controlled by external forces that they're not really worth teaching. Of course, if you have nobody to teach, then there's nobody to do the teaching, because we are simply also a part of a great manipulative scheme. Education Day is designed to manipulate. Designed to manipulate those who are being taught. It's designed to manipulate those who are doing the teaching, and of course to turn out a group of young citizens who will be easily manipulated. It is being designed, from the political point of view, to destroy American political society. I would say that Education Day is probably the greatest fraud being perpetrated in American people. It is basically dishonest. It is, secondly, it is morally bankrupt. Much of the problem with drugs emanates in the schools by laxity. Don't tell me that superintendents of schools and principals don't know what's going on. Some of them know and don't have the backbone to oppose it. Others know and condemn it. But today, the schools are the hotbed of crime, of illicit sex, and degeneracy. There's no doubt about this. A recent study has made a very interesting point that those states which have so-called the most lax laws in regard to school attendance are the schools, are the states with the lowest juvenile crime rate. The states which make the most in the way of compulsory attendance have the highest crime rates, which is something that we're thinking about. Now, thus, modern education is also intellectually bankrupt. As I said the other day in introduction, just take an average textbook. Today, college textbooks are showing this trend, with less and less factual material, less and less important interpretive material. High school textbooks are impossible. Textbooks for the elementary schools are hopeless. And together they spell out intellectual degeneracy, anti-intellectualism, on a broad and a vast scale. We who teach in college receive the products from the high schools. And those of you who teach in seminary receive our products. If you stop to think about it, the modern high school does not teach as thorough a work as what we used to call the eighth grade or the grammar schools used to teach. The average high school text today is not nearly as good as the textbooks they used to use in the grammar schools. You can prove this. You take a grammar book in English of 100 years ago that they used in the fifth and sixth grades, and the high school graduate today does not know it. In fact, he could hardly master it. As a matter of fact, college students don't know it. We have a required course at Catullus called English 100. It is a course in composition, writing, and spelling, which every student has to take, and he has to pass it. And they give them tests when they come in September and determine whether they'll take it the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter. Those who are the poorest by these tests take it the first quarter so they can take it the second quarter and the third quarter. Those who are the best take the last quarter in hope that they won't have to take it again. Because if they do, then it clogs up the whole schedule for next year, you see. Well, they don't pass or fail in the sense they get a grade. They have to pass with a P. The failing rate for those who take it in September is about 40%. It drops down to about 30%. For the second, and it goes down around 10 or 15% to a third. But if, say, 300 freshmen who take the course, over 200 repeat it, something like that, the next year or in the second, third quarters, as the case may be. And our students are ranked above the national norms in these things. They're not poor students from the point of view of ability, and they're not poor students even from the point of view of national achievement, but they're poor students. They are poor students, and writing and spelling are a mystery to them, of gigantic proportions. You would hardly believe some of the funny things that they let go with exams and in term papers. It's almost unbelievable what they come up with. And there are minor variations and major themes, and sometimes major variations and major themes, spelling, sentence structure, and whatnot. It just gets to be unbearable. Now, the question is here again, how did we get to be where we are? And I will do a great deal of this. This is one thing they've asked me to do. So in every area of American life, in its culture, in its ethics, in its education, in its philosophy, in its literature, in its music, in its political and its economic activities, it has declined from its early origins and from its original philosophy, its original belt and chain, its original theism. Now, so far, thus, I've been analyzing the situation. From now on, I want to show how we came to where we are in the realm of American jurisprudence and in American government, second theme, the third in American education, and the fourth, the decline in theology. From our Puritan background down to where we are or where we aren't today. I think I can do this in about 8 lectures. And then in the final lecture, I want to show what might be called the area of Reconstruction. But these next lectures will be, from your point of view, probably pessimistic. They will be pessimistic because the scene which they treat is pessimism. Now, I will do a great deal with American theology for the simple reason that while I recognize the importance of economic, social, political, military, and diplomatic factors in history, I recognize that man, as created by God, even in a simple state, is intended to be a rational being. And what he thinks determines what he will be. Unless we are really, quote, off our rockers, we do think about what we're going to do. We do think. And writing to his constituency, as a young man of 24 years of age, as he first took his seat in the Continental Congress in the year of our Lord, 1783, the Honorable Charles Pinckney, a delegate to the Continental Congress from the state of South Carolina, in a letter to his constituents, wrote as follows. We may think wrongly upon right principles, but we must forever do so upon wrong ones. For how can the stream flow pure when the source of truth is polluted? Can you imagine a member of Congress writing back to his constituents along those lines today? And we think we're advanced? First of all, do you think that the average constituent would understand Charles Pinckney if he should start a letter home from a member of Congress and begin that way? Secondly, how many members of Congress would have the educational qualifications to discuss such questions with his constituents? And Charles Pinckney was no different from any other members of that body. He just happened to write these things. I happened to find them. And I read these three letters which he wrote back, which were printed, incidentally, by the editors of the Charleston State Paper. Amazing what he could see. Amazing what he could write. And if you read the other men that day, they wrote equally profound letters. But his appealed to me because that one particular paragraph which I quoted to you, which was a direct quote. Yes, we are intended to be rational. And thus, what we think has a great deal to do with what we do. Thus, the pervading philosophy of any era tends to determine the nature of that era. And the pervading philosophy of that era is interesting because it tends to react upon the theology of that era if the church gives into it. So that, as I shall show you, Hegelianism in Europe, or Kantianism in Europe, had profound impact upon American historical development, upon American theology. Darwinism in England, both as a Weltanschauung and as a biological theory, had a profound impact upon, Marx in Germany and in England, and Wagner in Germany, and upon a post-war thinking in this country after 1870. So that these movements are extreme importance because our present problem in political life did not come overnight. Some politicians would have us believe that Mr. Nixon started. That is far from the truth. Our present economic plight did not begin with either Kennedy or Johnson or Eisenhower or Nixon. To a great extent, it began in 1933. With the 100 Days Congress and the beginning of the New Deal, to a tremendous extent. Our educational plight began over 100 years ago with the writings of Horace Mann. Our cultural decline began in the 1870s. Now you say, why have they taken place for over 100 years? Because we in this nation had a tremendous heritage, a heritage which had a tremendous degree of inner strength. And it did not yield overnight. It did not decline overnight. but it could take a tremendous battering. It would be, as it were, a great steamship like the Queen Elizabeth II or the old United States, the United States line, or some of those great liners, plowing their way through the Atlantic. And with their inner-built stabilizers, you would hardly know the storm was raging unless you got up on deck and looked down and could see the tremendous waves. But the boat was so stable that it plowed through the seas with almost no vibration or any yielding to the storm. And this is what has been our, this has been true of our own tradition, of our own heritage. But finally, it yielded to the storms, the philosophical and the theological storms of the last 100 years of American history. And this has brought us to our present plight. Now, in all this, I'd like to give you something of a clue. I point out to you that modern history in general can be characterized as an unending conflict between the basic principles of the Reformation on the one hand and those of the Renaissance on the other. These are incompatible movements. They spring from very different sources. They have very different ends in view. They have very different frames of reference. And they are, of course, to summarize, totally different Weltanschauung, Woldenite views. Now, in this country, this basic conflict, which characterizes modern history, is present. And on the philosophical level, I would say that it is the conflict between humanism and naturalism on the one hand, and theism on the other. On the political level, it takes shape as an unending conflict between democracy on the one hand and constitutionalism on the other. Now, in a philosophical shape, of course, democracy was basically a philosophy which demands certain types of political, social, economic organization. But underlying the American heritage, of course, was what we call Puritanism, and it is to this to which I would direct your attention. For now, I'm going to first discuss the great issue of American jurisprudence. Bob and Don asked me to discuss three great issues, to which I added a fourth, and that was the decline in theology. But they wanted me to discuss the decline in American jurisprudence, the decline in American political life, the decline in American government, third, the decline in education. To explain these three declines, however, I shall have to discuss the decline in theology. Martin Smith referred the other day to Charles Finney, and he suggested that I do a great deal with American theology. And so, within the time limits, I will do a great deal. I shall try to devote to American theology certainly an hour and a half. Now, what do we mean by jurisprudence? A jurisprudence in any country, except probably in the Soviet nations, is the knowledge, the understanding of justice from the point of view of what constitutes the law and the administration of law, and then the actual execution of the law in the courts, or the administration of law in the courts. In other words, what is law? What constitutes law? What is the content of law? What is the authority of law? What is the normative for law? And how is it to be administered? Now, thus, jurisprudence, then, was essential to the American way of government. May I say in beginning, when I use the word Puritan, I, of course, am using it in the way, in one sense, in which it has been used, namely that of the Puritans of New England. But may I remind you that all the colonies were Puritan in their outlook, even though not necessarily in their origin. That Puritanism may not historically be restricted to Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire. But the Dutch Reformed of New York were Puritan in their basic theism. The Dutch Reformed of New Jersey were basically theistic. They might differ in language. They differed, of course, in confessional background, going back to Dort or Heidelberg Confession, the Second Helvetic Confession, as the case may be, and rather than to the Westminster Confession. But they were Puritan. They had basically the same outlook. The Puritans, of course, had a period of great control in Maryland, which not many people know about. The Virginia Company, when it was reorganized in 1809, was really as Puritan as the Massachusetts Bay Corporation in 1628. Many of the people who held stock in the Massachusetts Bay Company also held stock in the Virginia Company. And if you read the charter of the Virginia Company, it was chartered, among other things, to preach the gospel to the lost in Virginia. Its laws, its jurisprudence, its concept of law was the same as that of the Puritans of New England. It was, in essence, a Puritan colony. And Charles I was very much aware of this. The French Huguenots, who were driven out of France and a plot named Germany, and who came to South Carolina and to North Carolina and to some parts of New Jersey and New York, were just as Puritan, although they were French, as were the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay. This idea that there was a great dichotomy between the southern colonies on the one hand and the Puritan colonies on the other is simply false. There was in this country then a common understanding of what we mean by jurisprudence. And it held true in all the colonies, even though in some colonies the German element was predominant or the Dutch element was predominant. From the point of view of national origins, there was a common understanding of what was jurisprudence. As a matter of fact, in all the colonies except one, there was a requirement that the common law of England be the basic law of the colony, so that from the very beginning, these colonies began with a concept, a common concept of jurisdiction and jurisprudence at what it meant. Now, in order to give you this, I'm going to have to go back and look at, with you, the origins of English common law. Briefly, or the origins of Western law. When the Roman Empire fell, to a great extent, the Roman system of jurisprudence fell with it. The Roman law courts were no longer in operation in many parts of Europe, and no longer could you appeal to the emperor because the emperor wasn't there to be appealed to, and he didn't care if you did. So that by the year 500, the Lombards, the Burgundians, the Goths, and the Anglo-Saxons and the Franks were developing their own law codes using some of Roman law, so that by the year 500, the Lombards, the Burgundians, the Goths, and the Anglo-Saxons and the Franks were developing their own law codes using some of Roman law, but adding other elements to it, Christianity, so on. In England, however, something very unique and very interesting, extremely valuable, and very important took place. Contrary to what you're told in your high school and college textbooks, the greatest blessing that came to England was the Norman Conquest. You may not believe me, Professor Taylor, since you claim Anglo-Saxon rather than Norman background. But it is true that when the Normans came to England, William I showed great wisdom in his administration of his realm. And it was because of the way he handled the feudal structure in England that England developed English common law and did not have to undergo the trials of continental law development. I do not mean to ascribe this simply to William I, William the Conqueror, but certainly to the Angevins, Henry I and Henry II, and simply summarizing what they did rather than trying to go into great detail. They, unlike France and unlike Germany, were able to make feudal law, the common law of England. Now, the reason that's very simple. When William I conquered England, he forced all the feudal lords to subscribe to the Salisbury Oaths, by which they held land from him. So, in fact, as well as in theory, England became, for the most part, a great feudal pyramid. France did not. The Capetians of France were never able to unite France until long after the Middle Ages, down the 1470s, in the much later period. And when they did it in the basis of Roman law, which was revived. When Germany finally became united in the days of Frederick III, it became united on the basis of Roman law, which was a highly centralized administrative law. But in England, Roman law never took fruit. In England, English common law held sway. That was a very important development and had tremendous impact upon the whole development of English jurisprudence. Now, therefore, in England, although in theory it was true in France and in Germany, a very, very important legal principle not only was held theoretically, but was held in practice, obviously with failures. And I'm not trying to make it stated, I'm not trying to make the point that England was without fault, that all the English kings were great and were all great patriots. They weren't. If you have an Edward I, you have some opposites. If you have an Elizabeth, you also have to cope with a Henry VIII. If you have an Edward VI, you have a Mary, and so on. And if you have other great rulers, you have some of the kings of the 18th century, George I or George II. But be that as it may, England operated much more consciously according to the great theories, the legal theories developed out of Christianity and feudal law than any other country. Now, basic to English jurisprudence was a great idea, which is still in theory used, if not in practice. And it is this. Translating. Yes, Donna, following what Dr. Morton Smith said this morning and yesterday, yes, Donna belongs to God alone, the right to give law. No legislative body can create law in the medieval political theory. It is the function of the king, with his advisors, to jus decere, which can also be stated as lex. The word jus in Latin is the basic root word for justice. It is the function of God alone to be the source of justice and to speak the principle of justice to a people, or to his people, or to a nation. It is the function of the king to stikere, that is to speak or to apply the great principle of justice. Oh yes, to apply the great principles of justice. Now, this was fundamental to English political theory. If you would pursue this, C.H. McIlwain's great work, The High Court of Parliament, his other great work, The Growth of Political Thought in the West in the Middle Ages. To a degree, John Howell discusses it in his very great work, The Main Currents of Modern Political Thought. It forms the introductory chapters. Carlyle's great series of works on political theory in the Middle Ages. In some editions, 5 volumes, and others, 7 volumes. Holdsworth's great work on English common law. Pollock and Maitland's great work on the constitutional history of England. are also other sources as well as the English constitutional documents. But underlying all of the development of jurisprudence in England is the idea of common law, which is feudal law, commonly applied, which in its ethical and juristic concepts is biblical law. This marks the greatness of English jurisprudence. This is a very brief lecture for which I apologize to you, but I do not have time to go through Holdsworth, because Holdsworth was worthy of nothing else. And so was Pollock, so were Pollock and Maitland, probably more so. And neither of them can compete with the Carlyles for the amount of words they can put into a volume and the amount of volumes they can write. But if you study them, you'll see this very, very clearly. McIlwain is very clear. So this is the key to the understanding of English legal development. Out of it comes Parliament. Because Parliament originally was what? It was not a lawmaking body. It was a court. It was a court. Its great basis was to help the king in judicial work. Only gradually did it assume what we call legislative work. But even in its legislative work, it was essentially based upon the idea that it could not create law. That Parliament, the king, the Court of King's Bench, must always reflect the law of God. A law to be law must be in accordance with the revealed will of God. Now, this is theism at its best. I'm not trying to claim that England always practiced it. They didn't. But it was a theory. And they were conscious of the theory. Very conscious of the theory. And when you come to examine the problem of the Puritans versus James I, or the Puritans versus Charles I, this is uppermost in their thinking. For the absolutism of James I infringed upon this traditional historic political theory. And the Puritans, more than any group in England, were fully aware of the constitutional issues involved. James I, you know, said that Puritanism and monarchy agreeth as doeth God and the devil. So we cannot say he was not aware of the issues involved. He was very much aware of the issues involved. So now let's go to the founding of the colonies. I'm not trying to give a personal American history, but I am trying to show that when the colonies were founded, the colonies brought over with them men, the colonial leadership, who were very, very well trained in English jurisprudence and were very conscious of this heritage. John Winthrop was a lawyer. Incidentally, most of them were trained at Cambridge for the simple reason that Cambridge was the great, as James would say, the hothouse of pure evil, namely Puritanism. But beginning with Thomas Cartwright somewhere around 1570, Cambridge took the precedence over Oxford, not only as the intellectual center of Europe, of England, but also as the theological center, and became the great stalwart defender of the whole Puritan tradition, and was a great university. So that when these men came over, it was not by accident that they founded Harvard on the Cambridge model. Harvard was little Cambridge, and was consciously made that way. They said that in the charter, for the same purpose. So that Puritanism, when it came to New England, when it came to the Virginia Company, when it came with the Huguenots of South Carolina, when it came with the Scotch-Irish, when it came with the Dutch Reform, and with the German Reform, they came with a common theistic view. Now, the Germans did not have the English common law. The French did not have the English common law. But the proprietors made English common law the basis for the Carolina Colony Charter in 1663, before it was, and of course after it was divided also. It was the same thing for New Jersey, the same thing for Connecticut, the same thing for Virginia. These colonial trading companies and the proprietors had to have a legislative program in their colonial assemblies which was in harmony with their English tradition. It was required. And the court system was set up accordingly. very similarly, for instance, in Virginia, in Carolina. So that the principles of jurisprudence were maintained. And if you go back to the history of law in Virginia, it appears again and again and again, the great principle of underlying theism, that the law of His Majesty's colony of Virginia is His civil law, His criminal law, is based upon this great tradition. It's worth noting. Of course, modern liberals spurn the whole Puritan tradition. And they frown on the Puritan control of their children. They frown on the Puritan system of justice. And they frown on the Puritan concept of law. But it's an interesting thing to note that there was a very, very strong family relationship throughout the colonies. Not merely in so-called Puritan New England, but throughout the colonies, wherever this Puritan tradition took hold, it had a tremendous effect. The Puritans had a very, very low crime rate, a very low crime rate. You hear about the stocks, and they were very effective. You hear about putting people to death, and that was even more effective, in more ways than one. But you see, they consciously applied biblical principles to concrete situations. And they knew exactly what they were doing. And they did it for a reason. They called it New England. Because they were not seceding from Old England. But what did they really have in mind? They wanted a place where they could not only have religious freedom, that was only part of the issue, where they could apply a basic theistic concept of government to a concrete geographical situation, namely their colonies. This is exactly what they had in mind. This is exactly what the Virginia Company had in mind. This is exactly what the settlers in New York and New Jersey, what the Dutch had in mind. What the Huguenots had in mind. And so, this great principle of jurisprudence was born and established in the colonial tradition and became a living, vital part of the colonial tradition. And you can see now, of course, how different this is from what we practice today. Now, the question, of course, is how did we lose it? So far, I've been simply dwelling upon the tradition with which we were blessed and with which we were endowed in the founding of the colonies. Incidentally, if you take the year 1787 as the end of the colonial period, many great colonial historians did. This C.M. Andrews, for instance, Chitwood, for instance, and others. And you take the year 1607, and you go to 1787, you have 180 years. And if you go from 1787 to 1967, you have 180 years. In other words, our entire national period from the Constitution on is only longer than the colonial era by 7 years. And the only way to understand American history is to understand its colonial origins. For they do occupy 180 years of our history, of the 367. They occupy almost half of it. Now, how did it decline? All human institutions are subject to decline, let's admit that. But they don't decline without active historical forces at work, which help to bring about that decline. Obviously, the Puritan ideal was hard to maintain in government, in education, and of course, in jurisprudence. And yet, it had a remarkable virility. Now, let us note that the clue to American history on the political level is the conflict between democracy on the one hand and constitutionalism or theism on the other hand. Let us always remember that. For this is the key point. The higher your form of government, or let's put it this way, the more biblical your form of government, the more difficult it is to maintain. And the reason for it is very simple. If that political philosophy, if that philosophy of jurisprudence is based upon a well-defined theology, it will suffer the same type of attack which the theology suffers. Thus, American colonial jurisprudence, whether it be that of a royal colony, as Virginia, after 1625, or that of Massachusetts Bay, or that of Maryland, or that of the Carolinas, or some other colony, really bore the imprint of a Calvinistic frame of reference. Thus, as Calvinism came under attack, so did everything which grew out of it came under attack. As a matter of fact, in many, many cases in this country, Calvinism came under attack simply because it was the foundation for a political system and a philosophy of law which they did not like. A very well-known writer in his American Temper, a book, has said, and he's given a very tremendous statement, this statement, that the radicals of the American Revolution realized that in order to dethrone a sovereign king in Great Britain, they must first dethrone a sovereign God in heaven. And this is true. And some of them were very frank to admit it, and others just did it without admitting it. In other words, the American Revolution, basically, a movement for democracy, was anti-theistic. This is recognized by some leadership and not by others. And I'm not for a moment suggesting that Christians did not take part in it. They did. Notably John Witherspoon, who at this point is an enigma, except for the fact that he came to this country having fought the English in Scotland, and it had gotten to be a habit with him. And no matter where he was, he fought the English, having had troubles with England and in Scotland earlier, before he came to Princeton. But the colonial leadership was aware of this fact. And no one was more aware of it than John Adams, who made some right pithy statements concerning radicalism, of which he was deadly afraid. So that as the democratic philosophy made its headway into this country, by 1710, first used by John Wise at a church choir in New England when he was getting after the Mathers, it gradually, the democratic philosophy under the impetus of John Locke gradually made its way in this country through the English royal officials, some of the, particularly the governors of Virginia, some of the governors of North Carolina and elsewhere, who were educated in Oxford and who had drunk deeply at the wells of Lockean philosophy. It came in through the Anglican clergy, particularly in Virginia, who also were aware of it. And it came in through other royal officials, customs officials, naval officials, and occasionally through colonists who went to England and who studied. It came in both ways. So that in the 18th century, the whole Puritan tradition ran into sharp conflict with the political philosophy and the jurisdictional philosophy of John Locke. For, as I shall show you in a lecture on the decline of government, and these two lectures, of course, are closely related, the impact of Locke, whatever Locke may have been personally, the impact of John Locke was deadly. Not only does his empiricism spell out irrationalism and anti-intellectualism at almost at its worst, but it is a deadly thrust at Christianity. Now, I would agree that you can say that Locke didn't intend to be this way, because he wrote a book in defense of faith, but it's a very shaky defense. It was really an attack on the faith, although he may not have realized it. But even at the time of the Revolution, whatever its philosophical implications may have been, it did not do great harm to the American system of jurisdiction or jurisprudence. It could have, And if it had had its way, it probably would have. But the concept of law remained essentially intact, in spite of Jefferson, in spite of Locke, in spite of the radicals. The system of jurisprudence remained essentially intact. The colonies, when they became states, retained their whole colonial common law system. They changed names of place, they changed some things, but basically, Virginia common law in 1790, 1800, 1810 was what it had been in 1750. The same thing was true of the other colonies. But gradually, after this, our system of jurisprudence began to decline. And declined drastically after 1865 for reasons which I shall show you later. But it began to decline in the age of the rise of the common man, which was a disaster for the whole American tradition because it brought in a fresh wave of democratic thinking, which shook to the very foundations the concept of common law. Although here again, the common law did not die overnight. And it took it to, well, I don't know what date you would set, probably 1910, in some cases 1940, 1930, even in some cases 1940. But common law today, and our system of jurisprudence, has virtually disappeared from what it, in the sense in which it had been given to us, and in the sense in which it had come from England, as a method of administering the law as seen in the revelation of God in his scriptures. And so, Das Salis.
The lecture you've just heard was by Dr. C. Gregg Singer, professor of history and chairman of the history department at Catawba College, Salisbury, North Carolina. For an expansion of the material contained in these lectures from a philosophical and a historical view, we would refer you to Dr. Singer's other tape messages, The Christian View of Philosophy and The Christian View of History, each series in 5 cassettes. Dr. Singer's latest book, The Unholy Alliance, soon to be released by Arlington House of New Rochelle, New York, will be another invaluable reservoir of ecclesiastical history on how we got where we are.